Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Matt Migaki, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians. We talk all about their lives and music while sharing killer craft beers. If you've ever wanted to sneak backstage and share a beer with one of your favorite musicians, well, Vox and Hops is the podcast for you. This week on the podcast, I dropped an amazing episode with Dom Grimal of The Last Felony, Ion Dissonance, and Cryptopsy. There is this episode and over 450 other ones to help you enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. So what are you waiting for? It's time to become a Vox and Hops head. Cheers!
Very excited to talk with you today, Finn, about your financial journey, because I know it is a very interesting one. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do this.
All right. So tell us, what do you create on the internet?
I make videos about the history of music is sort of the thing most people probably know me for. I'm also very active on LinkedIn and some other places, but most people know me for my YouTube stuff.
What got you into it? Like, what was the path that led you to creating that content?
So my career has been in product design and marketing for the last 25 years or so, which is unfortunate to say because it dates me, like everyone to think that I'm 15 years younger than I am. But unfortunately, I've been doing that for a long time. And as a marketer, you know, you should always understand where people's attention is. And I mean, that's the game, right? It's like, how do you get someone's attention and, you know, convert them into paying you for the thing. And so I had done a lot of writing in print, and I had done some, you know, back in the 90s and 2000s, I started out doing, you know, fanzines when I was like 14. And then I had some blogs that were reasonably successful. And I saw that YouTube was sort of the next thing around like 2017, which I consider like late to the YouTube game, but I guess maybe it's not. But I felt like I was late to it. I just said, well, I want to understand this as a marketer. So I'm going to start a channel. And if I can just get like a couple thousand subscribers, that would be enough for me to say, like, I understand this as a marketer, you know, and I can put that as a bullet point on my resume. Cause, you know, if you get 2,000 strangers to click subscribe, I would say that, you know, that's not like a huge channel, but it's enough to say that you know what you're doing, I think. And it ended up being much bigger than I ever expected it to be. And I was like, well, I guess it'd be dumb to stop now. So here I am 7 years later.
And I love it. And I don't think you're late. Like, that's about, I got on 2017. So I feel like that's too late to get into all of this, but
I mean, it's never too late.
Never. It's never, you can get on tomorrow. Like,
totally.
I hope that that's what we want. Like, get on YouTube now.
Absolutely.
If you're not already there.
The best time was 10 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yes, 100%. Share with us where you were when you started your channel. Like, what was the situation that allowed for you to pivot from like doing this product design, marketing stuff into just focusing on the music content full time?
Well, I never stopped doing that stuff, but not because I have to. I mean, I make more than enough money from YouTube that I could do that full time. Like, I make probably four times more from YouTube than I did at my last 9-to-5 job. So like, I don't need to do that stuff. I continue to do it because I like to, because, you know, I don't think of myself as a YouTuber. I think of myself as, you know, as a product designer and a marketer that happened to find success on YouTube, but like, that's not how I think of myself. So, but to answer your question, I was working at a company called Creative Live from 2013 to 2017, which was like a Silicon Valley startup that did online education for creative people, mostly like photographers. And it was cool. I liked it, but I had the chance to kind of move into another role as a partner in another company doing online education, which I still do, called URM Academy, which is, we make online education for music producers. And as part of that, you know, because I'm a partner in the company, I can make my own schedule and do what I want. And I said, well, I'm going to start doing YouTube too, partly to benefit our company, but also just because I wanted to do it. And, you know, that enabled me to kind of do it. And like I said, it ended up sort of taking on a life of its own. But I mean, it was a big leap of faith, you know, of like, why should I spend so much time on this thing that, you know, certainly beginning, it's unlikely that it's going to make you any money.
And here we are. People still don't understand what I do as a job most of the time. So they often ask me what my husband does when I tell them I'm a YouTuber. So it's just a whole funny thing for sure. I'm really curious, though, about your YouTube channel. So your YouTube channel that you have had your success from is the Punk Rock MBA.
Yeah, I have another one that's just my own name that's similar kind of content, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that this is the one that, like, when I think about, like, as a creator and a YouTuber, like, I mean, there's a lot of people out there. We've had them on the podcast. I do it myself, like a lot of YouTube consulting, and we'll dive into some of those details later. But I would love to know about the journey to the Punk Rock MBA. Like, why that content? What was it about it that drew you to creating this content? And what were those early days like for you financially around that channel?
Yeah, well, it was a lot of zeros. That's the early days. So the original focus, so the name of the channel, the Punk Rock MBA, was originally the idea was that I would talk about business for kind of people from a non-traditional background because, you know, obviously I come from like the kind of music world, but I've been able to sort of find a career for myself doing, you know, quote unquote grown-up jobs. And so I wanted to make content for people like a younger version of me that's like, hey, if you come from a non-traditional background than I, like I did, how do you sort of navigate your way in the real world of having like, you know, a grown-up career? Well, turns out nobody cared about that. And so I put out, I don't know, probably 50 videos or something like that along those lines of just really went nowhere. And I had written a lot about music and stuff in the past. And I had, you know, somewhat of a following, but not much, like a couple thousand people maybe knew who I was from that, which, you know, I don't want to diminish that, but it's not like I had some giant following or something like that. And so I sort of knew that I had proven that I knew how to talk about that stuff and generate interest. And I was like, well, I guess I'll drop the business stuff, even though that's kind of my passion. I'm going to drop that because it seems that nobody's interested in it. And I know they're interested about in this other stuff. So I'm going to try that. And as soon as I did that, that's when, you know, I really hit that hockey stick kind of moment and the channel took off.
What were your first taste of income that showed you that I like this pivot into the Punk Rock MBA was like the way to go? And what was some of your early income streams there?
I got monetized. I think it took maybe 8 or 9 months or something. Just sort of a lot of small videos that were getting whatever, 120 views or something each. And then I had one video that got like 2,000 or 3,000 views because someone else shouted it out on, you know, someone with a big channel, a guy named Fluff, Ryan Bruce, who's a good friend of mine, awesome guy. And then in another video about a band called Bring Me the Horizon, which is the one that really took off. And I got monetized from, I don't know, somewhere along the way. And I started making, I was like maybe $1,000 a month or something like that, which at the time I was thrilled with because, I mean, for me at that time, that was like a lot of money. And I think, I mean, for anybody, you know, $1,000 a month is nothing to sneeze at. And that's definitely enough where it's like, wow, if I'm making $1,000 a month with this sort of, you know, without really knowing what I'm doing and, you know, things being this rough around the edges, then what's the potential of this?
I can totally understand that. What was like a really bad financial situation that you found yourself in around the Punk Rock MBA?
You know, I've never really had one because I've never depended on this for my income, which is the reason why I basically have three jobs because, I mean, I grew up poor and I never had any money until I was probably about like 34 or something like that. And so I always, you know, for better or worse, I always just sort of operate, you know, with like plans A, B, C, and D in mind so that anything in my life could like, you know, financially, like any of my income streams could go away tomorrow and I would be fine. So I've never really had a financially bad moment. I just work harder than probably most people would enjoy working. So that's sort of the downside of it. It's like, I don't worry about money, but I don't have a life.
We got to find that balance. It's really important. I think it's where a lot of people can like experience burnout and feel overwhelmed and things like that. How are you finding balance so that you're not hitting burnout?
Well, I don't. And I've been burned out for years, but I'm in the position to make way more money than I ever thought I possibly could. And I am not going to let that slip through my fingers because this is an amount of money that if I keep doing this for another couple of years, like it's not like I'm going to have fuck you money and I can, you know, retire on a desert island, but it's enough that you can be like, okay, if I never saved another penny for the rest of my life and I just leave this in index funds, I'm going to be good when I retire. I mean, I'm basically there now, but I would like to have a little bit more of a cushion, maybe pay off our house or something like that. But that's sort of my incentive. And I get why people talk about work-life balance and I get this whole idea of burnout and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it's like, well, if you want to do something extraordinary, it's going to take extraordinary effort. And the people who you look up to that have achieved the things that you say you want to achieve, they don't have balance in their life. Like, that's not how it works. I mean, there may be a few people that are sort of fortunate enough to pull that off, or they have balance because they push themselves really hard for, you know, a decade, and now they have the ability to coast and chill a little bit. I get it. But at the same time, I think the failure pattern more often than not is that somebody doesn't work hard enough. It's pretty rare that someone that there's somebody I know where I'm like, you need to chill. Like, you don't need to work this hard. I would say that that does happen, but that's rare.
Obviously, this is where you are now. How did your path to being this way go? Like, what were some of, like, let's start with you three. Like, what were your first three income streams that you established from being a creator? And like, where do they come from?
The first one, I mean, if we're talking specifically about YouTube, the first and sort of that side of me, because again, I started making fanzines and stuff when I was like 14, and I managed to sell thousands of those through the mail by the time I was out of high school. So when I was like 15, 16 years old, I'm going to the post office to like mail stuff to Finland or whatever, because I was getting like dollar bills in the mail from these people. But as far as YouTube goes, AdSense was the first one and is still the biggest. After that, I started a Patreon at some point, maybe 2018 or 19 or something like that, which is, you know, continued to just like, I don't have the biggest Patreon in the world by any means, but it grows slow and steady, and I'm cool with that. And then the real, I would say the real turning point there was I got a manager, a good friend of mine named Tony, who does all my brand deals. And so starting in, I think 2018, maybe 2019, you know, I've had 1 to 3 brand deals a week between my two channels. And that, you know, adds up to a lot of money over the course of whatever that is, like 5 or 6 years.
One of the biggest things that so many creators will like scream from the top of like the rooftops is don't rely on AdSense, and AdSense should not be your number one income stream. You, when we look at your pie chart, it's 60% of your income.
Yep. I make a shitload of money from AdSense, and I don't think my channel is huge.
Help us navigate through AdSense. Like, why are you like fine with AdSense being your number one income stream?
Well, I think the reason why it works for me is because my RPM is pretty high. It's like, you know, probably around $8 or $9, depending on sort of the month. There's other people I know where it's like $3 or $4. And if I was making $3 to $4, you know, PM, then it would be a different story. And I think this is just because of the nature of my audience. Well, there's a few things that I did. Number one, I think it's the nature of my audience, being that they're like 30 something American men, which is, you know, an audience that's very attractive to advertisers. So I think that, you know, that drives up their CPM and therefore my RPM. The other thing is that once I sort of realized this and understood that the algorithm rewards watch time, I made my videos longer. So they were like 12 or 14 minutes or something. And then I was like, wait a minute, if I make them 20 minutes, the algorithm will like that. And I can put another couple ads in there. I'm very aggressive with the amount of ads I place in my videos. And I've only gotten a couple complaints about that. I know a lot of people are kind of nervous to do that, but I haven't really experienced any pushback from that.
I have a curiosity around your AdSense with your ad placement. I know that you can like set it where like YouTube automatically will place your ads in your mid rolls.
Oh no, manually do it. Yes.
Okay. So do you manually? So how do you, like, as just like a tip for like going through this, like what is your process for manually placing those ads?
So I do them now every 3 minutes. There's other people I know that have done tests and say that if you do an ad placement every minute, that that's ideal. And I have tried that too. I didn't see that it made a difference for me, but maybe I did something wrong. But just so everyone knows, when you put an ad placement in a video, that's not guaranteeing that an ad is going to show at that place. If you were to put an ad every minute, that doesn't mean that every viewer is going to see an ad every minute, because Google is smarter than we are. And they know how many ads you're willing to put up with. So if you're the type of person that leaves a video after seeing one ad, then, you know, YouTube is going to show you less ads. So I think that, and it says this in YouTube Studio when you do it, but just so everyone's clear, it's a chance for an ad to be shown, not a guarantee that an ad will be shown. And so that maybe will help people be a little bit less nervous about it.
Well, and I also think the reason I like the manual placement of the ads is because then I get to kind of dictate the natural break in like my cadence or my information. Or
I don't
like,
even do that. I just play them every 3 minutes. I probably should.
I do a lot of tutorials and like concept stuff. So I want to make sure the breaks are kind of natural. Like if I'm in the middle of showing something, there's an ad, it would just really, I think, throw off my viewer experience, which I'm always
trying to maintain. I get a few complaints about that sometimes, but whatever.
I like though that every 3 minutes is like a good like way to keep it pretty standard. I had looked at my ad placement about mid-2023 when I had like when I wasn't manually doing it, and they would be placing ads like at the end of my videos and stuff. And I was like, no.
15% of people are even going to make it there.
I know. And it's also kind of one of those things like, I know I talk fast and like I respect my audience's time so much. I'm like, you don't need to hear me breathe. Like, that's fine. Like, we'll talk a little fast. You can slow it down if you need to. And so YouTube could not find the natural breaks in in my case. That's like, that's what I had discovered from it. So by doing the manual placement, it allowed for like the better conversion opportunities for
sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. So with your Patreon, walk us through how you have funneled your audience to Patreon. What is the value that you're giving on Patreon to your subscribers over there?
Yeah. So at first I just gave people early access to my videos, which I think some people cared about that. But for the most part, I think most people, I think, just subscribed because they wanted to support me and enable me to make more content in the future, which is awesome. And that's why I there's a lot of people I support on Patreon. And I honestly never even look at it. I just, you know, give them money every month because I want them to be able to do more of what they do, which I think is a common thing. But the thing that I found made the biggest difference is because people in bands like hit me up all the time wanting me to, you know, give my thoughts on their music or whatever. And so I created a tier where you can submit a song to be reviewed live on Twitch every month. And that proved to be kind of the biggest kind of growth opportunity. And I stole that idea from a guy named Colin Moriarty, who does he has a company called Colin's Last Stand, or I guess it's Last Stand Media now. I stole that idea from, he has like a tier where you can submit a Q&A question that he answers every month. And I said, oh, I'm going to do that, but for bands. And that turned out to work.
How many people do you usually like average, like for your Patreon, who compared like your subscribers that you have on your channel?
Not a lot. Like right now I have maybe 400 paying patrons or something like that. I don't put a ton of effort into Patreon just because it's not a priority for me. It's possible, like, I don't want to do stuff like exclusive videos for Patreon. It's possible that that would be an opportunity, but just for me, it's a lot of work. And, you know, probably realistically 50 people are going to watch it. And it's kind of like, you know, am I going to make a whole video that only 50 people are going to watch? It's hard for me to justify that.
No, I totally respect that. But I love that you're honest about like how you're not prioritizing it and it's not a priority. A lot of what people have talked about on YouTube is like, if you're not, you can't rely on what YouTube is going to do to help you with your audience. Like they're like, if we're relying totally on YouTube putting our video content in front of them, like we could be missing out on people who actually want to see your content. Yeah. Are you doing anything to like list build or anything like that to help drive traffic?
I see a lot of people say that. And a lot of those people, when I look at their content, like, well, you're not making content that takes advantage of the algorithm. You know, I won't name names, but there's one person on Twitter who's constantly saying this. And then I look at his videos and I'm like, well, no shit. Like, your views are kind of mediocre. Like he has a lot of subscribers, but his views are mediocre because this is not algorithm friendly content.
There's two different kinds of content that like when we're talking about creators, there's two different, like you and me, like we're wildly different creators. Like I am education and you are like super fun and trendy and like something that anybody can relate to.
Kind of. I mean, I'm not fun, but yes.
I think that's subjective.
I literally summarize Wikipedia. That's what I do.
But you're still doing something that like more people are attracted to. Like more people are attracted to like music and punk rock videos than they would be to like how to figure out how social media works for their business, because the vast majority of people like don't have a business.
I mean, possibly, but I think this is a story that people tell themselves, and I don't think it's true, or it doesn't have to be true. You know, for example, there's tons of people, like I would call this, I mean, these are the kind of people that I work with as a consultant a lot, and I would call this category edutainment. And the place where I think people go wrong is they go way too hard on the edu part and not hard enough on the tainment part, right? For example, like, I don't know if there's a guy named Ben Mala. I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he does like real estate investment type stuff. He gets, you know, 800,000 views reacting to like investment TikToks. He delivers lots and lots of valuable information in the context of being entertaining at the same time. I'm not directing this at you in particular, but I think this is just a story that a lot of these people tell themselves. It's like, my kind of content isn't inherently not algorithm friendly, so they just sort of give up. I think that's a cop out. I think there's a way to do both, because we know that there's people that get millions and millions of views. I mean, Graham Stephan, another good example of this. They get millions and millions of views talking about educational content topics. You just got to package it the right way.
And I think that there's different strategies. Like, I don't think there's one way to be successful on YouTube. And I think that you have to find what works for you. I know from my personal experience with what I do with my personal brand, my personal content, taking all of the advice and doing all of the things that everyone talks about with like algorithm friendly, and like it wasn't working. Like literally the like damaged my channel massively. But going back to some foundational things and mixing in new modern strategies, I'm now seeing the build back and the growth, and all of the things that matter to me as a business owner are activating in the way that I need them to.
The reason that I push back on this is because, you know, this person is like, well, did you know that you could make this much money, whatever it was, 200 grand a year or something, you know, off a relatively small number of views. All you need to do is also have an email list and a course and an e-com brand that does blah, blah, blah. I'm like, bro, that's three fucking jobs. Or I make more than that from AdSense with one job.
There's no one right way to do it. And I think it really depends like what you're good at, what you're talking about, who your target demographic is. I love that your breakdown of the CPM about like I'm talking to a specific demographic that basically has money more than like, you know, these like 18-year-old gamer kids who are just like it makes sense that they get targeted for like all of the pop and soda, you know,
yeah,
snack content, right? That those commercials. But I think that like there's a lot to consider. But I think at the end of the day, the statement that you said that is most important is it has to be content people want to watch. It has to be able to be interesting and hold their attention. Even if I am doing something that solves someone's problem, if it's really boring and really dry, they're not going to stick around. Or yes, if it's too slow, or if it's like hard to see, like there are still expectations that our viewers have when they're coming to YouTube and looking at our content.
Totally. It isn't an entertainment platform at the end of the day. And I understand, you know, there's another sort of use case for it of like a search engine for when you need to do a specific thing, like, you know, whatever, how to install a Roomba or whatever it is.
Right.
So that's another use case. But my point here is like, I just think there's a lot of people that hold themselves back by not taking advantage of the algorithm, specifically by refusing to make content that's a little bit more entertaining. And by the way, I'm not an entertaining person at all. Like, I'm really not. So the fact that even by my standards, people are playing it safe, I think tells you a lot, because there's a lot of people out there that are way more creative and entertaining than I am.
That's all, I think, very subjective. With our third income stream that you talked about, that like your first three that you dug into when you're getting started, it was around brand deals. How did the transition from brand deals to having a manager do it for you, and what he does for you now? Like, what was that process like?
So he managed and did brand deals for some other people that I knew. For example, the person some people might know is a guy named Jared Dines, who's like a pretty popular guitar YouTuber. And so he had worked with Jared and some other people. And I ran into him at NAMM, which is like a big convention, like a music industry convention. And he was like, oh, I love your videos. If you want me to sell ads for you, you know, I could fill it up with mobile, you know, game ads all day for this much money. And I was like, cool. And it was only a couple hundred dollars a deal. But at the time for me, I was like, all right, I mean, why not? And that's grown over time. But yeah, basically my thought with him is like, my job is to make his life easier, because a lot of people can be a pain in the butt to deal with. You know, they say no to deals and they're slow and blah, blah, blah. And so my approach with him is like, I just want to be his easiest client, that all he does is he sends me the brief. You know, I'm fast with everything. I'm meticulous. You know, I don't give him a hard time about anything. I just want him to send as much work as possible my way, because it's easy money for him and therefore for me.
So how does he get you your brand deals? Is like he managing your inbox, or is he like, yes, finding the deals and bringing them to you?
Both.
Or a little bit of both?
Both. So he's, you know, my business email contact on YouTube is his email.
Okay.
Just because I don't like, all I'm going to do is forward it to him anyway. So why not just have it be his? And I know him and I trust him, you know, and part of that is because he had worked with other people that I trust. If it was just some nobody that I didn't know, I probably wouldn't do that off the bat. But because he had worked with Jared and some of my other people that I know, it was fine. We just have a spreadsheet. It's like, hey, I just signed this. It's for, you know, February week three. It's this company this much. I'm like, cool. Hit me with the brief. That's it. That's our process.
I love how easy that is, because sometimes it can get really, really complicated and that. But I think what's interesting about what you have mentioned, and we had other guests on our podcast I talked about too, where someone, their manager manages their inbox. So many people think when they get a brand manager, they're going out and finding the brands for them, not managing the inbound ones that are coming in.
So he does both, just to be clear.
Yeah. So walk us through the misconceptions I think that a lot of people have around managers, and when should people be really considering getting one, and what should we expect them to do?
Well, I know a lot of people have had bad experiences with managers. I've only had one manager, so I can't really comment on sort of the breadth of all the experiences people have. But the way that he does as far as getting deals for me, it's not like, I mean, maybe some managers do this, but it's not like he's going to go cold call a company. Like, I'm like, hey, Tony, I really want to deal with whatever Dollar Shave Club or whatever. Can you go get that for me? That's not how it works. The way it works is that he has relationships with agencies, and agencies are sort of the people that hold the keys to all this. So there's a lot of middlemen involved. There's the client, which is, let's say it's whatever, Snickers or whatever. Now, Snickers, and they have a bunch of money to spend on this campaign. Let's say they've allocated $1 million to this influencer campaign. Snickers is not going to have direct relationships, or at least this doesn't typically happen. They're not going to have direct relationships with, let's say it's, you know, $1,000 per influencer is what they want to pay. That's 1,000 influencers to spend $1 million. Snickers is not going to maintain relationships with 1,000 different people. What they're going to do is farm that work out to one or more agencies who will then reach out to managers who then reach out to the influencers. So sometimes I'm like horrified. I'm like, okay, if I'm getting paid this much, you know, there's 4 people above me that took a cut. So, you know, I'm probably only getting 30% of what was actually allocated to this, but you know, whatever, that's just the way it is. So yeah, that's sort of how, at least in my experience, that's kind of how the thing is structured, if that makes sense.
So because you've had a lot of like unique opportunities with brands and things like that, what's been like the coolest brand deal you've gotten to do?
Well, I really like, I wish they would come back. I'm a big fan of Skillshare and Squarespace because those are both like legitimately really good products that I think are awesome and I used before they sponsored me, but they haven't sponsored me for a while. So they're dead to me until they give me money again. And then we're best friends again. But one company that's really supported me a lot for the past couple of years is Factor, which I also think is a really good product for real. And they're easy to work with. And I think it's like genuinely a good product. And that's really all I ask for.
What is your measurement of a successful brand partnership? Is it just financial output, or is it long-term relationships, like affiliates and payment? Like, what's your like perfect relationship look like?
I mean, in a perfect world, I would like to actually deal directly with the brand, but I also worked at agencies for like 15 years. So I have probably a level of, you know, experience there that not very many YouTubers do. So I feel like if they would work directly with me, we could come up with something, you know, and Tony, of course, but if they would work directly with us, I think we could come up with something that would give them a lot better bang for their buck than sort of, you know, just getting the same script they send to 50 other people. But I also understand, you know, because I have a background in that stuff, but I also understand why that's not scalable for them. But I mean, that'd be cool. I would love to work with like Skillshare or something, because I've been making online education products for 10 years now, over 10 years. So like, this is a space I know a lot about and I have a lot of deep conviction in, and I feel like I could do something cool with them, but that's up to them.
So when we look at your pie chart, you have just the 5 streams of income. You have AdSense, us, your sponsorships, and your membership, which we have already talked about. But you also have a 1% that comes from merch, and then 6% that comes from services that you provided. Can you share with us what your services are and like how they came to be?
Yeah. So I've sort of done, you know, consulting here and there for years. Like, just someone will reach out to me like, hey, you know, someone that I know or a friend is like, you know, we want to start a YouTube channel. Our company has a YouTube channel, but you know, it's not, you know, doing what we would like it to do. Can you help? And so I would just, you know, always help them. So I've been doing that for years, sort of semi-formally, but towards the end of last year, about maybe 6 months ago or so, I decided that I wanted to pursue that a little bit, you know, more deliberately. So I created a couple offers around that and said, and pivoted like my whole LinkedIn presence to sort of emphasizing that. And
hey, you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends, Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony, also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little a little taste of it, right down to the shaking microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick, and usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work, but we talk about decidedly not-so-grown-up things like...
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from niche music podcasts that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe Grind Podcast.
So now I have a couple different ways of working with people on that. And I've been putting a lot of time and energy. Like, I'm spending probably half my time on that now, even though it's like a relatively small percentage of my income now. But, you know, in a future world, like, I want someone like Canva or Figma, you know, that they kind of do okay on YouTube, but they could be doing a whole lot better. I would like them to give me like $100,000 to help them be 100% better at YouTube. And I think that would be the best $100,000 they ever spent.
So talk us through like what that service would look like. Like what is $100,000 get these people?
Well, that's a question. I mean, when you're talking at that level, you know, that's a large conversation, but I'll tell you what it looks like for the individuals that I work with now. So, you know, for example, someone might come to me and say, hey, I have a channel where I talk about remote work and I'm getting, you know, 1,000 views a video or something like that. And that's cool. And, you know, there's definitely something here, but I'd like to be doing, you know, 10 times that. How do we get there? And so typically the way that I work with people, I think that's my favorite kind of person to work with, is like where they already understand how YouTube works and they know how to make videos and stuff. It's just sort of looking for that. What is that one little pivot that's going to get you that hockey stick, just like it did for me when I pivoted to just talking about music. And I like edutainment as a space because I have a lot of, like at Creative Live, I worked on the CEO's content team there where we did a lot of this stuff. So, you know, his podcast and blog and all that kind of stuff. And we did all these, it was like 2013 to 2017. And we did stuff with, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk and Tim Ferriss and Richard Branson and all those kind of people in that space and stuff. And so like that sort of edutainment thought leadership space is something where I'm like very, very comfortable and I'm good at that. And so I think for most of these people, the trick is what we talked about before is like, these are subject matter experts that have a ton of valuable stuff to talk about. What they need is a little bit of help in like wrapping that in a tight concept that's a little bit more accessible. So it'll just open up the top of their funnel, right? Just get more views is what they need. And so typically what that means is like repackaging it in a way that's just a little bit more entertaining, but still retains the essence of what they're trying to do, which is to show their expertise.
So who would like your dream client be?
Well, like I said, you know, Figma or Canva, you know, basically, or even a smaller, company, but I would like to work, you know, I worked at startups and stuff, so I understand a lot of this stuff. I worked at a lot of stuff for like giant companies like Procter & Gamble and stuff. So I understand how this sort of thing works. I understand how to steer the ship of the giant corporate marketing machine, which is tough to do. But a company like Figma or Canva that does okay, you know, some of their videos will get a couple hundred thousand views, which is awesome, but then others will get like 2,000. So you can see that it feels to me like when they're successful, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's an accident, but I don't think that they have like a consistent, reliable strategy, but we know that people care about the company and care about their brand because there's people getting millions of views talking about Figma and Canva, usually individual creators rather than the brand. So I would like them, you know, to basically, I would like to work with them and help me unlock, let me help them unlock YouTube for their company. You know, what if you were getting 5 million views a month, 10 million views a month, and converting some portion of those people into the next step of your funnel, whatever that is, you know, sign up for your newsletter, product demo, you know, whatever, that's going to depend on the company. But I mean, I think for just about any company getting, you know, tens of thousands of people dropped into the top of the funnel every month, I think that would move the needle for just about anybody.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that I've been kind of like on my pedestal saying that like this is the year 2024 is the year that brands start really paying attention to YouTube as a place for them to create content and build up their authority rather than relying on others as well.
Right, so exactly. There's people that are talking about your product, you know, and that's awesome. You don't want them to stop, but wouldn't you like to have a little bit more of a driving role in that conversation?
Oh yeah. Well, like people are going to be talking about your product, whether you like it or not. So you might as well be there to like answer the questions, manage the expectations, and don't use your YouTube as a dumping ground for
your CEO's keynote that nobody cares about, you know, or some sales webinar.
lots of tutorials on how to do things. Yeah. Webinars.
And they always have the same excuses like, well, we're not really focused on views. It's search, blah, blah. Like, okay. Well, your videos get 1200 views. Does it sound like this strategy is working?
Yeah. That's 1200 views. That's a lot of eyeballs. That's a lot of people in a room.
Okay. Well, it could be 12,000 or 120,000. Right? I would say for Microsoft to get 1200 views is a fucking complete faceplant.
Agreed. Especially considering how big their brand is and what they're doing. Yeah. But it's not, they're also the same company that have completely screwed up Xbox. So who knows what's going on there.
Yeah, not good at consumer. But so either shut down your channel or do it right.
I think that that is fantastic advice that everybody, every business, at least the very least, should pay attention to and all that kind of stuff. What are your thoughts on how creators are not attaching business to what they're doing as creators? I personally find that a lot of the reason that I think a lot of creators struggle and go through all of the burnout and things like that is that they're not, there's not like a business and attached to it that's yeah. making it like financially beneficial for them to keep showing up to their job, which is to be a creator. Yep. What are your thoughts on that? And what could they be doing to fix that?
Well, I don't know if this is exactly what you're thinking about. And if it's not, then tell me. But the thing that I see the most from talking to people is this sort of tension between the content they want to make and the type of content that actually drives revenue. And I understand that because, I mean, that's real and I feel the same thing. But it's sort of a question you need to answer for yourself. You need to sort of be okay with making that trade-off of understanding that there's a certain type of content that's going to get views and drive revenue. And if you want to make money, you need to make that type of content. And if you choose to make content that you know is not going to be appealing to your audience, then you can't really be upset when, you know, your revenue isn't what you would like it to be. Now, there's, of course, on the other side of that, you know, there's all the other things we talked about of, you know, all the different revenue streams, which many other people have talked about in a lot of depth, and like all that stuff is awesome. But that to me is sort of the biggest failure pattern I see is just that people are unwilling to make the content that their audience wants because they don't find it creatively fulfilling. And I get that, you know, but that's, I mean, there's a lot of content that I make that's not creatively fulfilling to me. But, you know, for me, it's like a slider, like in a video game. And for me, the slider is all the way on the revenue side. Like, I do not care at all about creative satisfaction, or maybe a very, very tiny bit. Other people, the slider is all the way on the other side. And there's no one right or wrong place for that slider to be. That's a choice for you to make as an individual, but just understand that that is a choice. Unless you happen to be one of the people that magically gets to do both, is the content that you make that's really creatively satisfying for you also gets tons of views. And if that's you, then awesome. I'm happy for you, but it's not the case for most people, I would say.
I think the people that are always seeking creator satisfaction are the people that don't understand that YouTube's also a job.
Yep.
Like this is my job. Like, my job is to create content, is to show up and be a certain way, be attentive, ask better questions, like think about things all the time. Like, what's my lighting? What's my sound? What's happening? How do I streamline my process? What's my thumbnail going to be for this? Like, as we talk, I'm writing down notes and I'm like, okay, what's going to be the introductory quote for this? Ooh, this would be a good like graphic for it. Like, it's a job. It's a thought process. It's a thing that I do minimum of 40 hours every single week. And people think that because it's creative, that it's not a job. And I think that that is something when it comes to money specifically. I'm not opposed to people that are like, I need a creative outlet. YouTube is what I'm doing to like make my heart happy. I'm like, cool. That is great for you. And I love that you get to do that. But for people that are like, and especially those that are listening to this podcast and stuff, like where you're like, YouTube is a way for you to make revenue and money and have an income and live a life that, well, unconventional and different, is still another way for you to make money, have a job and income, all that kind of stuff in like a different and unique way. And I think that that is the thing that a lot of people forget about. And I think that burnout comes with the fact that, like, kind of like when people get sick of their jobs and they don't want to do them anymore. And so they just like emotionally quit or something like that, or they sell or they go do something else. Like, it's one of those, like, I think important things that a lot of people like don't realize about YouTube. And I think that comes also from the other end of it. Like, I was telling to you, I told you earlier, people ask me all the time, like, wait, what do you do? I'm like, full time YouTube creator. Oh, what does your husband do? Like I couldn't possibly be like,
it's not making sexist enough or anything.
It's like, how's that little business of yours, or how's that network marketing business that you have? I'm like, no, I'm actually the person that works in my house. My husband's a disabled veteran. He doesn't work. And so they're like, they literally do the coyote, like double take, like what? Like you make, I need like a much
better. I mean, what an amazing opportunity that you've been able to do that.
It's an opportunity that was, I had to make work for me because I ran into all of the cliche issues of motherhood where it's like, oh, why is there this gap in your resume? Why did you go be a mom? What was the military life? Like all of that stuff. And so it was like, well, this is what I'm good at and this is what I enjoy doing. So let's make this work. Let's make this the income stream that provides for our family. And that ended up having the situation with my husband and his recovery and all of the things. And so, yeah, so this is my job. Like I don't have the luxury of being creatively burnt out because I have kids and a mortgage and a husband that all need me to provide for them. So my job is to find a way to make this job something I want to do every day that is like fulfilling for me so that it's not hard for me to do it and make money. And I've definitely hit my lulls. And it's just a matter of like pivoting, trying new things, making my content better than it was before and moving on from there. So I think that the best thing that anyone could do when it comes to having a job, when it comes to being a creator, is to think of it like a job, but something that like you, a job you want to do that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, I get to do this. That's how I try to think of it. Even if it's a subject I'm not that excited about. You know, I mean, you said you were in the military. Did you enjoy every day of that job?
Oh, I was in the military. My husband was, okay. But I know he did not.
Yeah, sure. I mean, any job.
I'm a mom every day. I don't enjoy being a mom every day.
Like, of course not.
No.
I have a 9-month-old and he has been waking up every 90 minutes for the past couple weeks and I don't love it.
No, it's hard. And and if you're like me, like I need to sleep, I'm going to kill you kind of a thing.
Or yeah, but what are you going to do? Like you're going to get through it. That's what you're going to do. And so I think one advantage that I had with YouTube is, you know, before I did any of this stuff, I had, like I said, I had been a professional designer and marketer for 20 years before I started doing YouTube. And you understand that that job is not about, you know, when you say you're a designer, it's not, you're not an artist. So they're not paying you to make the thing you want to make. They're paying you to make the thing that they need. Right. So if I'm working on, you know, I did a lot of stuff for like brands like Bounce and Febreze and Swiffer. And like when I started working on Bounce, which, you know, is fabric softener, I was like 25 years old or something. I had never bought 25 year old dude. I had never bought fabric softener in my life. I barely even knew what it was, you know, but it's like, well, you know, here it is. Like, this is the job, is we need to do X, Y, and Z with this product and you need to design it. I'm like, well, okay, we're going to do it. And, you know, there's a part of the job that's creative and sometimes you get to do things that are really cool and creatively satisfying, but not always. And that's just the way it is. And I don't, you know, YouTube is no different. In fact, if anything, you know, YouTube has the most creative freedom of any job that you could possibly have. You can do whatever you want. That doesn't mean the audience is obligated to watch it, but you can do whatever you want. You know, you wake up tomorrow, you make whatever video you want. There's no boss telling you what to do. You just have to understand that the audience may or may not be interested in it. And it's your choice whether to make the video or not. Like I said, I put that slider all the way. I put the audience first every single time. I make the content that I believe that they want to see. And sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I get it wrong. But my job, my friend Adam from No Jumper said this once on a podcast once, and it really just changed my mind about everything. Someone's like, well, Adam, why do you do blah, 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 blah? He's like, well, I'm a YouTuber. My job is to make content that people want to see. And I was like, that's it. That's the job. Right. And that just really, for me anyway, that's how I think of it. And that really just changed my mind about everything.
I think that that is a great way for us to really wrap up our thought process. And it's important for us to remember that as well. What is your next money move, Finn?
I would like to turn my consulting into the majority of my income, maybe in the next year or so. That's my goal. And whether I stop doing YouTube completely or just, you know, dial it back, I don't know, but that's my goal.
I love that for you. And I look forward to following that journey. You can follow his journey with him with all the links that we have in our show notes over at The Funded YouTuber. Again, thank you so much for your time, Finn. Until next week. Peace. The Funded YouTuber is brought to you by Gigastar, a parent company of Gigastar Market, an SEC-registered funding portal and member of FINRA. Learn more at gigastar.io. Music provided by APM Music, unrivaled music to bring your stories to life. Neither Gigastar nor its affiliated companies provide legal, regulatory, financial, or tax advice. Any opinions expressed herein are those of the authors and are the informational purposes only. The information and opinions expressed herein are subject to change without notice and do not take into account the particular investments, objectives, financial situation, or needs of any specific investors.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. from Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.